Hoosier leaders react to DACA's impending repeal. Curtis Hill butts heads with the CDC. That plus praise for Joe Donnelly's centrist approach and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 8th, 2017.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, President Trump announced he will potentially end the DACA program in 6 months and urged Congress to act.
DACA shields some undocumented immigrant students from deportation. It was created in 2012 by President Obama and has been criticized since as unconstitutional. Now, the Trump administration announced it will end in 6 months, or maybe not, as President Trump seemed to walk back his threat a bit after the initial announcement. But he urged Congress to act on the issue in that six-month window. And Hoosier Republicans largely praised the president's move for that reason. Lawmakers Todd Young, Luke Messer, Todd Rokita, Jim Banks, and Susan Brooks all hailed the shift to congressional authority to resolve the issue. Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly urged Congress to restore DACA, and Democratic Congressman Andre Carson called the president's move a devastating blow.
Can Congress act on immigration reform, at least DACA reform, in 6 months? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, President Trump received praise for essentially putting Congress on the clock. Will this be an effective strategy?
You know, they have had years to deal with this problem, years to deal with it. Now, President Obama stepped in to prevent the deportation of 800,000 Dreamers. They have a lot of incentive to do it, but they've shown themselves as completely ineffectual so far. I mean, they've got majorities in both houses and the presidency, and they can't pass anything of any substance. Now, I hope they get to work on this and adopt the kind of overall immigration reform, including the Dreamers that Joe Donnelly proposed in 2013, got out of the Senate and couldn't get out of the House. So it would be nice if they worked in a bipartisan fashion to resolve a really serious problem, because it's not fair to children who were born here in no other country to be deported somewhere where they may not even speak the language very well. So we do need to do something, and I hope they can be a lot more effective than they have been to date.
Broad immigration reform would be quite an almost Herculean task, and I think it was John Cornyn who said, if that's going to be part of it, this isn't going to happen. But because there seems to be much more bipartisan support for at least keeping DACA alive, do you think this is achievable in the time frame that the president has laid out?
It could be. I think this is a process. This is a process decision more than anything. I mean, you had a policy, just an administrative policy, sitting there, and it was about to face a serious constitutional challenge. Yeah. So the president did the right thing and said, "Look, Congress needs to go make a decision on this." And at the end of I'll give them 6 months to do it. At the end, we'll figure out where we're at. We have Republican majorities in both houses of Congress. We have very conservative members in the House. It's going to have to be a bipartisan approach. So if Democrats are going to dig in and under no circumstances, or just continue to say we're not going far enough, then I don't think we can get a bill out of the House. The obvious place to come to try to pull the Republican coalition together is on border security. You could bring in elements of border security that the president wants, and elements of DACA that the moderates want, and you can put together a pretty broad coalition.
That's been rumored this week. Is what if they try to tie funding for President Trump's border wall with Mexico? What if they try to tie that to DACA reform as a way to sort of force Democrats into voting for it? Do you think that is something that would happen?
Now, politically, I would guess if I were advising the majorities, Republican majorities in the House and Senate, I would say, do you really want to kiss off any chance of carrying national office, you know, in 8 years, in 16 years? Because look at the demographics of our country. The Latino population is growing. The demographics aren't what they were, you know, even 10 years ago. And it seems that the alienation, the attempt to alienate that segment of our population, and I'm not talking about undocumented, I'm talking about people who are U.S. citizens who actually go and vote, This might be a bit of a time bomb that could blow up in an unexpected way. But we'll see. And now there was this is only one part of the dispute. We also have now new legal challenges. Mike mentioned earlier that a lot of, he thinks the president's actions this week were spurred in part by a court upcoming challenge. But now you have at least, I think, 12 states where there are Democratic attorneys general who have filed suit. And then Janet Napolitano, who as Barack Obama's Homeland Security Director and is now president of the University of California system, filed federal suit today. Yeah. So that may take this.
It's already bipartisan.
But a lot of that would be dealt with if Congress acts.
Oh, that granted.
In that window, President Trump though came out. We heard it was first the reports, and then Jeff Sessions came out and said 6 months from now it's gone. And then President Trump, in the wake of that, goes, "Well,
maybe
we'll
not.
See what happens in 6 months." Is that going to dilute the effect that this threat had?
Look, Congress, unlike everyone else, is a creature of deadline. We see that all the time. We just saw it this week with the debt ceiling debate. The problem is, if you don't have a hard deadline, or at least say it's a hard deadline at the start, then it's not going to be respected by Congress. The other thing is, the attempt at bipartisanship is going to be difficult given the 8 years where the Republicans said no to everything that came in every proposal that came into Congress. And it's pretty easy to say, well, we could have done this during the Obama administration the, quote, right way if we'd had cooperation from Republicans at that time. So the stance really is whether the Democrats want to get something done or if they want to say, look, you know, you've got enough people, you can get this done. And you didn't help us out, so why should we help them out?
I don't think they want to do that. I think they want to solve this problem, but they want to solve it. I mean, just extending the Dreamers Act is not enough, okay? They have to have a path to citizenship. They don't have a path to citizenship now. So they're in limbo, and we're extending the deadline during which they're in limbo. We need to have a pathway, which means comprehensive reform.
And now you're talking about broader reform, which, as you mentioned, will make it more difficult for a bipartisan solution,
but
at least
time.
In that time frame.
It's time.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will Congress enact legislation to legalize or reform DACA within 6 months? A, it will legalize the current program. B, it will reform the current program. Or C, it will not pass a DACA bill. Last week's question, should police be able to purchase military surplus equipment, which could include armored vehicles, grenade launchers, and riot gear? A, 39% say yes, they should. 61% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Attorney General Curtis Hill this week accused the Centers for Disease Control of advancing a pro-syringe exchange agenda and manipulating data to do so.
Indiana's Drug Abuse Task Force last year finalized a report on syringe exchange programs. One of its conclusions was that drug users in Scott County, home of the state's first program, increased their drug injection from 5 times a day up to 9 times. That data point has been used by Attorney General Hill and others to suggest syringe exchange programs increase drug use. But the CDC says that's not so. Rather, it links the injection increase to a specific drug, Opana, which is more difficult to dilute and thus requires more injections. The CDC says its data suggests no real increase in drug use in syringe exchange program counties. Hill expressed incredulity that the CDC would seek to, as he puts it, alter findings to advance a pro-syringe exchange agenda.
Mike O'Brien, Curtis Hill says the CDC should want as much data information as possible, but isn't he rejecting information the CDC is providing to try to explain these results a little more?
I think the problem with this issue is too often the data is counterintuitive to what the remedy is. So you have record amounts of people, and Scott County is the worst example, who are using or injecting drugs. So the answer is give those drug users more needles. And so politically the reaction to that is that can't possibly be right. And then if you listen to Jerome Adams, the new Surgeon General, who back then convinced Mike Pence, who was no fan of that program to do that because of the data. You know, the gut reaction is one thing. The data-driven policy answer is a different one. So when this report came out and it showed that they went on average from 5 to 9 injections in whatever the time period was,
per day, right.
You would immediately conclude that the program was a failure until that you explain, well, people, the health officials on the ground needed time to understand what the injection patterns were for this group. And look, none of this is clean. I get the emotional reaction to it. The intellectual path to solving this problem is not clean. And you're never going to get a policy answer to this that people are going to go, oh, that seems like a great idea. Let's do that. Because it's just such a hard path to get these people to have a touch point to try to get these people in for care. But needle exchange is one of them. And it's been proven and advocated for successfully here.
So Curtis Hill butting heads with the CDC is perhaps of smaller consequence on its own, but now you're seeing in Madison County, for example, they ended their syringe exchange program in part because of arguments made that mirror exactly the sort of things that Curtis Hill has been saying.
I am shocked. I am really shocked that the CDC, controlled by Donald Trump, would lie to Curtis Hill. I mean, I just, and it would be pushing drugs. I mean, that's what the implication on this is, that we're not trying to wean people from the program, but we're trying to get more people addicted. It's ridiculous. Mike's right about this. It is one particular drug which is less effective and is taken more often. He's taking a little bit of the data and trying to extrapolate that out into a ideological and an appeal to hardcore right-wing voters that we should stop this. It is counterproductive. We have an opioid crisis in this state, and it needs to be dealt with without the ideology and without demagoguing the issue.
In the wake of the the HIV crisis in Scott County, you saw a bunch of needle exchange programs. It took a little while, but they were created. Now we've already seen one shut down since then. We haven't seen a lot new created since then, even though the legislature just made it easier to do so. Is this sort of dialogue or the sort of message that Curtis Hill is pushing, trailing off, tailing the effectiveness of these things off?
Well, I think that's certainly his aim here, because he is on record as saying that he's opposed to the needle exchange programs, and I think there's a significant number of people in his party who don't. Agree with this strategy. As Mike mentioned, Governor Pence was against this, was convinced that it was a good idea by his health commissioner, now the Surgeon General, and so it got into the process. But as you mentioned, the momentum seems to have slowed, and I think you can point to Attorney General Hill's opposition, and his expression is really that of a lot of people who are very much against this, and they're happy to see that happen. So you kind of have an internal struggle going on right now. Governor Holcomb has established the panel to look at this issue, to try to act on this issue, but at the same time, all the things that have gone into it to this point have seemingly slowed down. So we'll see where this comes out in the end.
Curtis Hill, being in such a prominent position, if you're someone on the other side, you believe in needle exchanges and you think Indiana needs more and not less of them, what do you do to sort of counter a person in that significant influential position saying these things?
I guess you wait and watch what happens. You have the spread of HIV AIDS. You see a much greater expense for the state and other public entities that fund the health care of individuals who in many cases lack insurance. I think all of the data show that if you just want to look at this, and you never want to look at any kind of medical question just in terms of dollars and cents, but if you did want to, needle exchanges are, I think, the long-term cheaper solution. But, I mean, this is just the latest example of an ongoing struggle, and Mike alluded to this, and this is John, that reminds me of condom distributions in schools, you know, during the AIDS crisis. We don't want to encourage people to do things. And actually, this is fairly consistent with Curtis Hill's view on this sort of thing, the notion that we don't want to aid and abet in any unacceptable behavior. And I'll just make the point back during the legislative session, he was a guest on lawmakers, and we were talking about Narcan and in terms of countering people who overdose on opioids.
Yeah, right.
And he sort of didn't take a stand, but he asked the rhetorical question, you know, how many times should we respond with Narcan to people who overdose? Almost again, the argument being,
do we want
you reap what you sow. Maybe as a society, you know,
we
just
let them die.
You get, well, that was the inference, I guess.
Well, the new profile of Joe Donnelly this week suggests his willingness to buck his party and side with the Republicans on occasion will help deliver him to victory next November. The roll call piece on the Hoosier Democrat pointed to a few instances where Donnelly sided against Democratic leadership, including his opposition to a Democratic budget proposal and climate change legislation. And it seized upon Donnelly's comments from last month in which he claimed that many Trump voters in Indiana are also Donnelly voters. The profile says Indiana voters want their political leaders to be centrists, and one voter said the GOP primary fight between Todd Rokita and Luke Messer amounted to a, quote, pissing contest.
John Katzenberger, after Donald Trump won by nearly 20% in Indiana, and I don't think anybody accuses him of being centrist, do Hoosier voters really want a centrist in their elected officials?
Well, the bet is yes, clearly, and I think the answer is yes. Donald Trump won by 20 points. That profile also quoted a number of people who said, I'm not very happy with what Donald Trump has been doing. There were some fairly negative characterizations of the president in that same article. So given Hoosier's overwhelming history, this becomes then a turnout race, as we've often said they always are. But the truth is the extremes have been better at turning out than, you know, everyone else in the middle. I think if the middle expresses itself, then that's very good for Joe Donnelly, and his record probably will look very attractive to people who are in the middle of the road. A lot of ifs built into that, but I think, you know, at this point, that's probably a positive.
So Joe Donnelly's betting on they want a centrist. Donald Trump this week makes a bipartisan deal with Democrats on the debt ceiling and hurricane relief, and Luke Messer and Todd Rokita both vote against it. So they're betting on they don't want a centrist.
I think you're right. That is sort of sets the stage for the debate. I think centrist, just look at it from a mathematical standpoint, where is most of the electorate probably is in the center. And I think what Hoosiers really want more than the R or the D really is a government that works at any level, whether it's at their local level, at state government. I think some people voted for Donald Trump because of the frustration that they had seen gridlock in Washington. Gee, nothing gets done. The Congress doesn't do anything. We want somebody who brings about change. Well, that hasn't happened. In fact, there's probably, aside from some of the executive orders he's been able to issue or those he's been able to rescind, there hasn't been a lot of change. So for Hoosiers wanting productive, pragmatic solutions to problems.
They want Joe Donnelly.
Not going that direction. I'm just saying they want centrist because they can work across the aisle to get things done.
In that profile, it was mentioned when Joe Donnelly did his campaign kickoff, he was quoted as saying that Trump voters are Donnelly voters, certainly not all of them. In either direction. But do you think there are going to be some people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and will go out to vote for Joe Donnelly in 2018?
Well, I don't think the Republican U.S. Senate candidate is going to win by 20. I think he's going to win. I think if you look back in the last, we always reach back and say, well, Barack Obama won in 2008. Evan Bayh won in 2004. We have, you know, Kernan O'Bannon.
Right.
This state is much different than it was 10 years ago. If you look at, and that's reflected most accurately, I think, in our House majorities, because of the seats that historically went to Democrats, because people in the South self-identified as Democrats and had for 100 years. Well, that fundamentally changed in 2009, and it hasn't come back. They haven't de-identified as Republicans. They continue to self-identify as Republicans, and they deliver big statewide wins and have, with one glaring example, which, of course, is Joe Donnelly in 2012, but we had a couple self-inflicted wounds down the stretch on that one.
Does there need to be somewhat of a self-inflicted wound on a Republican's part for Joe Donnelly to
win? I don't think so. In one sense it does, because the reason that they're self-identifying with Trump is because they have to get beyond the Republican primary. So they have to cater to the right-wing part of the Republican primary voters in order to be the nominee.
By 20 in the general election.
Then they have to go to the general election, and they have to face people who do want somebody who can get something done. They don't want the ideologues that both Messer and Rokita represent. They want people who can work across party lines and compromise, because that's what government's all about, which is why Joe Donnelly got the award from the Lugar Institute as the most bipartisan Democrat in the entire Congress. So he knows how to get things done, and he is not hampered by a right-wing ideology as both Messer and Rokita are. So he has 55% of the Republican voters with a favorable approval rating.
Trump won by 20, but he didn't win by 20 because people went to the polls thinking he was a consensus builder.
Right. Joe Donnelly.
No, they thought he was going to get something done, and weren't they surprised?
We're working on it.
Yeah.
Speaking of Joe Donnelly, he wants to force the Trump administration to present a plan to Congress for dealing with North Korea.
Donnelly is pushing an amendment to the annual National Defense Bill that would require the White House to develop and deliver to Congress a strategy to address North Korea's nuclear missile program. The Senate received a briefing this week from Pentagon, State Department, and intelligence officials on the North Korea issue, but Donnelly says he remains concerned about the lack of an effective strategy. The Hoosier Democrat, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, says he only sees operational plans for the military and what he calls scattered talks among diplomats, not a, quote, whole government effort.
John Chawna, should the White House be forced into delivering such a strategy, or should Joe Donnelly be trusting in military and diplomatic leadership?
Well, I listened to the speech, and I think even people in the current White House in the administration would be hard-pressed to disagree with anything that Joe Donnelly said. I mean, he spelled it out in a very nonpartisan. In fact, he went to great lengths to talk about all his work with Republicans and his respect for Republicans. So he framed it in that manner. But there are two issues here, one philosophical and one practical, that are probably hurdles to this type of proposal. One would be the philosophical, that how many voices speak on international matters such as this. Traditionally, we have ceded that role, not ceded. Well, I think it's actually not. It's in the Constitution. I guess that's a good way to cede things. To the executive branch, to the president. And so if the complaint is that there are too many, it's mixed messages, you don't want to muck it up with more messages. The practical
so
one
to
is,
the practical.
Is just simply, how do you enforce it? You're not going. It's an amendment to the but to funding. You're not going to withdraw funding from the military. So there's no practical problem as well.
Is this, as much as he made it try to be nonpartisan, is this really just about partisanship on Joe Donnelly's part? Does he just want to send a message to voters more than the president?
Well, it wouldn't be the first time a politician has done that, and it would probably be a pretty good message to send. I'm not going to say that was his motivation, but you can interpret it that way, certainly. You know, the president's record on diplomacy and specifically North Korea is kind of frightening. And so, you know, a measured response and a response that has, the force of Congress is a pretty good argument, in my opinion.
This is not the first time, though. I mean, the North Korean problem is not new. So Republicans now are asking, why didn't Joe Donnelly give this speech on the floor of the Senate four years ago?
It's clearly escalated, though, and with the amount of firepower that they have demonstrated, I think the threat has escalated. And a lot of us would like something better than a Twitter response on this issue. And the idea that somebody as volatile and unpredictable and temperamental as Donald Trump has his finger on the button and no one is in a position to stop him from either an advance attack or a retaliation with nuclear weapons, I think that's frightening. I think John is absolutely right. And we need to have some adult supervision because it certainly isn't coming out of the White House.
So is this speech from Donnelly because a Republican is in the White House or is it because of
Donald
the particular
Trump
person
in
the White House?
I think it's Joe Donnelly trying to play both sides. In the last segment, we talked about how Joe Donnelly said Trump voters are Joe Donnelly voters, and now he's sticking it to Donald Trump on national security. I don't think independent voters or middle-of-the-road voters are going to start flocking towards Democrats in 2018.
I think they would be nervous about him with his finger on the button.
All I know is in the past two topics, we've talked about imposing two deadlines on Washington. I think this may be a tall order indeed.
Beyond their abilities.
To that point, though, I mean, is this? You talked about the practical of enforcing this, but is it even practical to expect something like this could actually get through Congress?
Well, no. I think, given its history, it would be a minor miracle if Congress actually was able to have a debate about this and to come to consensus about something like this. Although it should, and it is certainly important because if nuclear weapons start to fly, we're all in deep doo doo. So, I'd like to think that Congress could do that, but I'm not very optimistic.
All right. Well, finally, the NFL is back as games get underway this weekend, and Colts star quarterback Andrew Luck will miss at least the first game of the season, likely more than that. Mike O'Brien, I won't even ask you about our beloved Chicago Bears, because that's a lost cause. So, without Andrew Luck, will this be another rough year for the Indianapolis Colts?
I think if the Chicago Bears have taught any lesson to the Indianapolis Colts, it's that you can't win without a franchise quarterback.
Should we expect?
And we haven't had one since the Lid Luckman era.
Yeah, that's true. That's probably about right. Do you think the Colts can make a splash this year?
Oh, I think they can, and I think Andrew Luck can be back. So, you know, let's wait and see what happens here.
In a weaker division, do the Colts still have a chance?
Sure, they have a chance in the AFC South, but, boy, I'd sure like to see some big linemen in front of him and take care of him a little bit.
So he's like a lacerated organ at the end of all
that. Yeah, exactly. No kidding.
I mean, how soon do we need to see Andrew Luck back on the field for the Colts to have a realistic chance?
That's our third deadline now in three topics that we're going to get back. They may all be tough
this
to
was achievable.
That's what I hope it is. So clearly he needs to be back in there if the Colts want to have a very successful season. They could still pull out some success because, again, you don't know what's going to happen to the other teams in that conference. You could have injuries of their quarterbacks, their
they
franchise
the
quarterbacks.
They have the easiest. The Colts have the easiest strength of schedule.
Yeah.
In the league.
Well, that's Indiana Week in Review. Yeah, let's hope for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.